trying to catch hold of the living-room table, but instead falling to the floor next to me, groaning. I staggered away, crawled to my feet, and looked at him. He was lying face down, with a knife in his back. When I turned to my right, I saw Smoot standing over him.
"Go,"
he said calmly. "Jack," I cried. "What have you done?"
"Go, the pair of you. Get out of here."
I made my way towards the door and looked down the staircase towards Bastian, who was struggling to his feet and rubbing the back of his head. Inyak reached down and looked at his father's face. The man's eyes were wide open and staring. One firm stab had been all it took. He was dead.
"I couldn't let it happen again," said Smoot quietly,
and I turned to him in confusion.
"Let what happen again?" I asked. "Jesus Christ, you killed him. And what'll we do?"
Smoot looked around and, to my astonishment, seemed to be perfectly calm. He was even smiling.
"I know exactly what to do," he said. "And I don't need any of you here to do it. Just go, all right?
Here's the keys of the bar. Lock the door behind you and throw the keys back through the letterbox."
"We can't just go!"
he roared, turning on me, spittle flying from his lips.
"I know what I'm doing!"
I could think of no alternative, and so I nodded and took Inyak by the arm and led him downstairs. Bastian was sitting on a chair, wheezing.
"What happened?"
he asked me.
"What's going on up there?"
"I'll tell you afterwards," I said. "Come on. We need to get out of here." "But..."
"Now!"
insisted Inyak, turning to him and helping to lift him. "If we don't leave here now, we never will." And so we left. We went out on the street and did as Jack Smoot had instructed us, locking the door behind us and throwing the keys back inside. We were home within 20 minutes and sat up half the night torn between guilt, hysteria, and confusion. When Bastian and Inyak had gone to bed, I found myself unable to sleep, and so I made my way back across the river and bridges and towards the canal, where I watched as a car pulled up outside McIntyre's, a rental car from the ads on its side, and in the moonlight I watched a dark, cloaked figure stepping out of it and opening the boot before knocking 3 times on the bar door. When it opened, Smoot gestured the person inside, and a few minutes later they reappeared on the street carrying what seemed to be a heavy rolled-up carpet, obviously containing the body of Inyak's father, for they struggled to hold him. They threw it in the boot before slamming it shut, and both climbed into the front seats. Before they drove away, however, the moonlight caught the face of the driver. It was too quick for me to be absolutely certain. But in that moment, I was certain that Smoot's accomplice in the disposal of the body was a woman.
1987. Patient 741.
Patient 497.
Every Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock, I left our apartment on West 55th Street and made my way towards Columbus Circle, where I took the B line 41 blocks north to walk across Central Park in the direction of Mount Sinai Hospital. After a quick coffee, I would take the elevator to the 7th floor and check in with Shaniqua Hoynes, the supremely dedicated and authoritative nurse in charge of the volunteer program, who frankly terrified me. On my first day there, having skipped lunch out of an almost overwhelming feeling of anxiety, she'd caught me stealing a candy bar from her desk and given me a severe dressing down before deciding forever that I was an untrustworthy person. Shaniqua, who was part of a growing team reporting to Bastian, always began by asking me the same question. "You sure you're ready for this today?" And when I confirmed that I was, she would reach over to a never-decreasing pile of patient folders, remove a list from the top and run her finger along a page before calling out 2 numbers, the number of the patient I was seeing that day and the number of their room. Occasionally she might offer some particulars about how advanced his or her condition was,
but more often than not, she'd simply turn her back on me, shooing me out of her office. Typically, many of the patients on the seventh floor had no visitors at all. In those days, even some of the hospital workers were terrified to go near them, and the unions were already asking questions about whether or not medical personnel should be put in danger's way. But in moments of depression or extreme isolation, they had put their names to the list of people hoping for an hour's company with a volunteer. One never knew, however, what to expect. Sometimes they could be grateful, wanting to tell you their life stories, but occasionally, in lieu of family members, they were simply looking for someone at whom they might lash out. Patient 497, room 706, was one of the older people I had visited so far, a 60-something man with plump, exaggerated lips. He glanced over warily as I entered the room, and let out an exhausted sigh before turning back to stare out the window in the direction of the North Meadow. Two intravenous drips were standing next to his bed, their bags filled with a fluid that seeped hungrily through the feeding tubes into his veins, while a heart monitor, its wires disappearing like thirsty leeches beneath his gown, beeped quietly in the background. He was pale, but his skin remained unblemished, as far as I could see. "I'm Cyril Avery," I told him, standing next to the window for a few moments before pulling a chair out from the wall and sitting down. I reached out to pat his hand in a pathetic attempt at making some form of physical connection between us, but he pulled away. Although I had been thoroughly educated by Bastian on the various ways in which the virus could be spread, I still felt nervous whenever I entered rooms like this, and perhaps it showed, despite all my attempts to appear brave. "I'm a volunteer here at Mount Sinai."
"And you came to see me?"
"I did."
"You're very kind. You're English?"
he asked, looking me up and down, apparently judging my fairly nondescript clothing. "No, Irish."
"Even worse," he said,
waving this away.
"My aunt married an Irishman. Total bastard and a walking cliché. Always drunk, always beating her up. The poor woman had 9 children by him over 8 years. There's something animalistic about that kind of behavior, don't you think?"
"Well, we're not all like that," I said.
"I never liked the Irish," he said, shaking his head,
and I looked away when I saw a snail's trail of spittle seeping down his chin.
"A degenerate race. No one talks about sex, and yet it's all they ever think about. There's not a nation on the face of the planet more obsessed with it, if you ask me."
His accent was pure New York, Brooklyn, and I wished he'd mentioned his racial prejudices to Shaniqua when placing his visitor request. It might have saved us both a great deal of trouble. "Have you ever been there?" I asked.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, I've been everywhere," he said. "I've been all over the world. I know the side streets and hidden bars and cities you never even heard of. Now I'm here."
"How are you feeling? Is there anything I can get you?"
"How do you think I'm feeling? Like I'm already dead, but my heart keeps pumping blood around my body just to torment me. Give me some water, will you?"
I glanced around and reached for the jug that sat on the bedside table.
"There. Over there,"
he snapped, holding it close to his mouth as he sipped on the straw. Those enormous lips were flecked with white, and I could see how deeply his yellow teeth were sunk inside his mouth. As he dragged the water through the thin plastic tube, an act that required enormous amounts of effort on his part, he stared directly at me with pure hatred in his eyes.
"You're shaking," he said,
when he pushed the jug away.
"I'm not." "Yes, you are. You're frightened of me. You're right to be frightened of me."
He laughed a little, but there was no lightness in his tone.
"You a fag?"
he asked eventually. "No," I said. "But I'm gay, if that's what you're asking."
"I knew it. There's something about the way you're looking at me, as if you're afraid you're having a vision of your own future. What did you say your name was? Cecil, was it?"
Cyril.
That's a fag name, if ever I heard one. You sound like a character from a Christopher Isherwood novel.
But I'm not a fag, I repeated. I told you I'm gay.
Is there a difference?
There is, yes.
Well, let me tell you something, Cyril,
he said, trying to sit up a little in the bed but failing.
I never had any problems with fags. I worked in the theater, after all. Everyone there thought there was something wrong with me because I had pussy. Now, they all think I'm a fag, too, because of this disease. They think I was hiding it all these years, but I never hid a goddamn thing. I don't know what bothers me more, the fact that they think I'm a fag, or that they think I didn't have the balls to be honest about it from the start. Believe me, if I'd been a fag, I would have told them, and I'd have been the best goddamn fag out there. Well, I would never have lied.
Does it matter what people think? I asked him, already tired of his aggression, but determined not to allow him to drive me away. That was what he wanted, after all, for me to leave so he could feel abandoned again.
It does when you're lying in a hospital bed, feeling the life seep out of you, he said. And the only people who walk through the door are doctors, nurses, and do-gooders who you've never laid eyes on in your life before.
What about your family? I asked. Do you have...
Oh, fuck off.
All right, I said quietly.
I have a wife,
he told me after a moment.
I haven't seen her in 2 years. And 4 boys, each one a more selfish prick than the last. Oh, I guess I can blame myself for how they turned out. No, I wasn't much of a father. But show me a successful man who's given his family everything they ever demanded of him, who can say differently.
And they don't visit you? He shook his head.
I'm already dead to them,
he said.
Once my diagnosis came through, that was it. They told their friends that I had a heart attack while I was on a cruise around the Mediterranean and that I'd been buried at sea. You have to admire their creativity.
He shook his head and smiled.
Not that it matters,
he said quietly.
They're right to be ashamed of me.
No, they're not, I said.
Oh, the funny thing is... I've fucked about 1,000 women over the last 4 years,
he said.
And not once in all that time did I ever get any kind of disease. Nothing. Not even when I was in the Navy, when, you know, most guys were 50% penicillin by the time they got discharged. So I guess it was inevitable that when I finally caught something, it was gonna be something big. You people have a lot to answer for.
I bit my lip. This was another familiar trope. A heterosexual patient lashing out at homosexuals for what he saw as their responsibility for the spread of both the virus and the disease that sprang from it. And I knew from experience that there was no point arguing with any of them. They couldn't see beyond their own suffering. And why, I supposed, should they? What did you do in the theater? I asked him, eager to change the subject.
I was a choreographer,
he said with a shrug.
I know. The one straight choreographer in New York City, right? But it's the truth. I worked with all the greats. Richard Rodgers, Stephen Sondheim, Bob Fosse. Bob came to see me a few weeks ago, actually. He was the only one who did. I was kind of him. Most of the others haven't bothered. Oh, those pretty young dancers. They do anything for a part in the chorus line, and I was happy to oblige. Not that I ever did any of that casting couch crap. I didn't have to. You wouldn't think it to look at me now, but I was a good-looking guy in my day. The girls, they all came running. I had my pick of them. Well, where are they now? They're afraid to come near me. Maybe they think I'm dead, too. My sons have done a better job of killing me off than AIDS has done so far. At least they were quick about it.
I don't go to the theater much, I said.
Then you're a Philistine. I bet you go to the movies, though, don't you?
Yes, I admitted. Quite a lot.
You got a boyfriend?
I nodded. I didn't mention that my boyfriend was the head of communicable diseases at the hospital. Had probably met him dozens of times and was the doctor in charge of his treatment. Bastian had made it clear to me from the start that I should reveal nothing about her personal relationship to the patients.
You fuck around on him?
He asked. No, I said. Never.
Sure you do.
I really don't.
My kind of fag doesn't fuck around. It's the 90 days, for Christ's sake.
I told you, I said. I'm not a fag.
So you keep saying,
he replied, waving this distinction away.
If you don't fuck around, then my advice is for you to stay that way and hope that he doesn't fuck around on you either. Then you'll probably both be safe. But if you're not doing it, then he probably is. There's no chance the only two monogamous fags in New York City found each other.
He's not like that, I insisted.
Everyone's like that. Some are just better at hiding it than others.
He started to cough. And instinctively I reared back in my seat, reaching for the mask that was hanging around my neck, and placed it across my face.
You little shit,
he said, looking across at me contemptuously when he'd recovered his breath. I'm sorry, I said, taking it off and feeling my face redden a little in shame.
I'm kidding. I'd do the same if I was you. Actually, I wouldn't even be here if I was you. Why are you here, anyway? Why do you do this? You don't know me. Why do you want to come inside this room, hmm?
I wanted to do something to help, I said.
Maybe you want to watch someone die. You get your kicks from that, is that it?
No, I said, that's not it.
Have you ever seen anyone die?
I thought about it. I'd seen several people die, of course. The priest who'd fallen out of the confession box on Pier Street. My first fiancée, Mary Margaret Moffat. And Iñak's father, of course, on that terrible night in Amsterdam before we decided to leave Holland for good. But I'd never seen anyone die of AIDS. Not yet, anyway. No, I said.
Well, stick around for the show, buddy. Because I don't have much time left. None of us do. Why, I see it. This is the beginning of the end of the world. And it's you, people, who my people have to thank for it.
Three types of lies. The restaurant was located on 23rd Street, near the Flatiron Building. And from where we were seated, I could see couples making their way through Madison Square Park, where, only a few weeks earlier, an old woman had spat in my face when Bastian, in a spontaneous moment, had put his arm around my shoulder and kissed my cheek.
"Fuck you!"
the woman, who was old enough to remember the Great Depression, had snarled at us, and there was so much invective in her voice that the other people walking nearby had turned around and stared.
"Fucking AIDS carriers!"
I would have happily avoided the area for a while, but Bastian's friend Alex, one of the doctors who worked under him at Mount Sinai, had made the booking not knowing what had taken place there. I tried to put the memory from my mind now as Alex's wife, Courtney, a journalist, drowned her sorrows, having been passed over for promotion earlier that day. The dinner had been intended as a celebration. Both she and Alex had been certain that the job would be hers, but it had turned into something of a wake instead. "I think I should quit," she said, looking downcast as she swept her fork ineffectively through her food, taking only the occasional bite. "Do something useful with my life. Become a brain surgeon or a garbage collector. My whole career has been building towards becoming lead White House correspondent, and for what? I've put so much time into getting to know all the people there, and instead that bastard gives the job to some guy who hasn't even been at the paper for a year and probably couldn't name the Secretary of Agriculture without looking it up. It's just fucked up is what it is."
"I couldn't name the Secretary of Agriculture," said Alex.
"Yes, but you don't need to name him," she said. "You're not a political reporter. And it's Richard Lane," she added under her breath,
as I knew she would.
"Did you talk to him about it?" I asked.
"Of course I did."
"Well, it was less of a conversation and more of an argument. Voices raised, name-calling, the whole nine yards. And I might have thrown something."
"What?"
"A plant. At the wall." Which just gave him the ammunition to say that he didn't think I had the right temperament for such a responsible position.
"What could have given him that idea?" asked Bastian, taking his life in his hands with a sarcasm.
"It's not funny," said Courtney, looking across at him angrily. "He couldn't even give me a good reason why I didn't get it. Well, he could, but he chose not to. But the truth is, I know exactly what happened. The White House put pressure on him not to appoint me. They don't like me over there. Reagan's people think I'm trouble. I just can't believe that he caved, that's all. Whatever happened to journalistic integrity?"
"Sometimes, if you can't believe something," said Alex, "it's because it's not true."
"But it is true," insisted Courtney. "I know it's true. I said as much to him, and he didn't deny it. He couldn't even look me in the eye, the little prick. He muttered something about the paper having to maintain important relationships with powerful people, but when I challenged him on this, he just clammed up."
"What's he like, anyway?" asked Bastian, who was far more interested in these matters than I was. He even read a newspaper every day, which was something I almost never did.
"Is he as stupid as people say he is?"
"He's not stupid at all," said Courtney, shaking her head.
"No one gets to be President of the United States if they're stupid. He might be marginally less intelligent than anyone who has ever held the office before him, but stupid? No, actually, I think he's quite smart in some ways. He knows exactly what he's doing. He uses his charm to get himself out of difficult situations, and people love him for it. They'll forgive him anything."
"I can't even imagine having a run-in with Reagan," I said.
"The closest I ever got to something like that was being punched in the face by a press officer in the Irish Parliament. The woman who ran the tea room had to pull him off me."
"So, what did you do to Reagan that was so wrong?" asked Bastian, who had heard the story before.
"Maybe we shouldn't go into all of this right now," she said, lowering her voice. "You and Alex don't want to talk work tonight. I'm just venting."
"Work?" he said. "Why, what has it got to do with our work?" "She challenged him about his response to the AIDS crisis during a press conference," said Alex. "And reporters are under strict instructions never to bring that word up with the president."
"And what did he say?"
"Nothing. He pretended that he hadn't heard me."
"Maybe he hadn't," I suggested. "You know, he's a very old man. I think he's like 80 or something."
"He heard me just fine." "Did he have his hearing aid in?" "He heard me just fine."
"Did it have its batteries in?"
"Cyril!"
"So he just ignored you?" asked Bastian.
"He stared down at me and gave me that little smile of his that he uses whenever his mind is drifting away, and you just know he'd rather be riding his horse over the prairie in Wyoming than standing in front of a bunch of reporters. And then he just pointed at someone from the Washington Post who asked some boring question about the Iran-Contra affair. No, what I was asking about was something far more controversial, something that hasn't been written about enough yet."
"Look, Reagan's never going to do anything to help us in this fight," said Alex. 18 months from now, we'll have another election, and Dukakis, or Jesse Jackson, or Gary Hart, or one of those guys, will be in the White House, guaranteed. After that, there's a lot more chance of our voices being heard. Reagan can't stand gays. Everyone knows that. He doesn't even like to acknowledge that they exist.
Society can't condone that lifestyle, and neither can I said, quoting the president in what I thought was a pretty good impression. And for the first time, I noticed a table of four sitting at the table next to ours, staring over at us with utter disdain on their faces.
"Fuck society," said Courtney.
"What has society done for any of us lately?"
"Margaret Thatcher says there's no such thing as society," I said.
"That there are only individual men and women, and there are families."
"Fuck her, too," said Courtney.
"The strange thing is," said Bastian,
"Reagan worked in movies and television for years before he went into politics. He must have been surrounded by homosexuals."
"Yeah, but he probably never even realized that any of them were gay," said Alex. You ever hear the story of how Charlton Heston didn't know that Gore Vidal was writing a love story for Ben-Hur and Masala? He thought they were just old pals from the Jerusalem kindergarten.
Reagan was probably just as clueless. It's not as if anyone would ever have made a pass at him, is it?
I had the misfortune of taking a drink from my wine glass as he said this, and it was all that I could do not to spit it all over the table. Once again, I noticed the table next to us and a woman seated there, shaking her head in contempt.
"A truly great American,"
I heard her husband say in a loud, aggressive voice.
"Well, what about Ruck Hudson?" asked Bastian, who was oblivious to our neighbors. "They were friends, weren't they?"
When Ruck Hudson died, Reagan said absolutely nothing despite decades of friendship,"
said Alex.
"Look, as far as the president is concerned, this is a gay disease wiping out gay people, and that, by its very nature, is not the worst thing that he can think of." It's been 6 years since the first case was identified in America, and all that time the man has said absolutely nothing. He hasn't even uttered the words HIV or AIDS once in public.
Anyway, I went to see the chief of staff afterwards, continued Courtney, and he made it clear that the subject wasn't even on the president's agenda. Off the record, he told me that the government would never put any substantial funding into research for a disease which was seen by the majority of the population as something that primarily killed homosexuals.
"Normal people don't like fags," he said,
grinning at me as if he couldn't understand what I was getting so worked up about. "So what does that mean?" I asked him. "That they should all die because they're not popular? The majority of members of the House of Representatives aren't popular either, but no one's suggesting that they should all be killed off."
What did he say to that?
He basically shrugged his shoulders as if he didn't care. But later that same day, I was coming out of the press room and making my way towards the West Wing to check a quote about something else entirely when Reagan just happened to pass me in the corridor and I pigeonholed him. I guess he'd forgotten me from earlier in the day, 'cause I got him to stick around by throwing a few softballs at him to get his attention. And once I had him hooked, I asked him whether he was aware that since he had first come into office, over 28,000 cases of AIDS had been reported in the U.S., and that of those 28,000 people, almost 25,000 had died. More than 89%. "I don't know if that's entirely accurate," he said. And here she did an even better Reagan impression than I'd done. "And you know what they say about statistics, don't you?"
"What do they say about statistics?" I asked.
I interrupted him, which you're not supposed to do with a president, and asked him whether he thought the administration should be responding in a more serious way to a pandemic of such enormous proportions, and one that showed no sign of slowing down any time soon.
"There are three types of lies," said Alex, looking at me. "Lies, damn lies, and statistics."
"And did he give you an answer?" asked Bastian. "Of course not," said Courtney. "He just grunted a little and smiled and his head twitched a bit, and then he said, 'Well, you gals in the press room know all the gossip, don't you?' And then he asked me whether I'd seen Radio Days yet and what I thought of Woody Allen. 'He's a leading man?' he asked me, scratching his chin. 'In my day, he would have been working in the mailroom.' Basically, he just ignored my question, and before I could drag him back to it, the press secretary came running down the corridor and told the president he was needed in the Oval Office. Once Reagan had gone, he gave me the mother of all dressings down and threatened to take my press pass away."
"And you think he spoke to your editor about your promotion?" asked Bastian. "You think he was punishing you for that?"
"Him or someone else in the administration. The fact is, they don't want anyone asking questions on this subject, especially not someone so closely connected to it. Someone who just happens to be married to an AIDS doctor and has the inside scoop on what's actually happening on the ground."
"Please don't call me that," said Alex, grimacing. "I hate that phrase. It's so reductive."
"Well, it's what you are, isn't it, essentially? It's what you both are. There's no point in sugarcoating it.
The fact is, until the heterosexual community accepts that this affects them too," said Bastian, putting his knife and fork down, "nothing is ever going to get any better. There's a patient in Mount Sinai at the moment, patient 741. You know him, Alex, right?"
Alex nodded.
"Have you volunteered with him?"
he asked, turning to me.
"No," I said.
for I had a pretty good memory for patient numbers. They seemed to tattoo themselves into my brain, and I hadn't encountered anyone in the 700s yet. He was first referred to me last year by a doctor at the Whitman Walker Clinic in Washington. This guy had been getting terrible headaches for a few weeks, and then he developed a cough that he couldn't shake. He tried antibiotics, but they hadn't done any good. His local doctor ran some tests, and she had her suspicions about what it might be, so she sent him to me for a consultation. I knew when I saw him that she was right. I could tell just by looking at him. But I didn't want to alarm the poor guy unnecessarily by saying anything until I was absolutely certain, so, of course, I ran the usual tests. "How old is he?" asked Courtney. "Around our age. No wife, no children, but not gay." He had that sense of entitlement and arrogance that goes with really good-looking straight guys. He told me how he'd spent a lot of his life globe-trotting and was worried that he'd picked up a bug along the way, malaria or something, and I asked him whether he was sexually active. "Of course I am," he said, laughing as if the question was ridiculous. "I've been sexually active since I was a teenager." I asked him whether he'd had many partners, and he shrugged and said that he'd lost count. "A couple of hundred at least," he told me. "Any men?" I asked him, and he shook his head and looked at me as if I was crazy. "Do I look like I have sex with men?" he asked. And I didn't bother answering him. When he came back in for his results a week later, I sat him down and told him that I was very sorry, but that I'd identified the HIV virus in his bloodstream, and although he had yet to develop full-blown AIDS, and we might be successful in warding it off for some time, there was a distinct probability that the virus would mutate into the full-blown disease within a few months, and of course, as he probably knew, there was no cure at the moment. "You know how many people I've had that conversation with this year alone?" asked Alex. 17. And it's only April. I had a sudden flashback to a moment I hadn't thought about in years. Sitting in a coffee shop in Rennell on the morning of my wedding and somehow finding myself looking after a 9-year-old boy, the son of the woman who ran the tea room in Dáil Éireann while she tried to phone Aer Lingus to book a flight to Amsterdam. "You're a bit of an oddball, Jonathan," I'd said to him. "Has anyone ever told you that?" 19 people this year alone," he told me. "And it's only May." "So, how did patient 741 take it?" asked Courtney. "You know, I feel like I'm in a science fiction movie calling him by a number. Can't you just tell us his name?" "No, of course not," said Bastian. "And he didn't take it well. He looked at me as if I was playing some crazy practical joke on him. Then he started shaking, visibly shaking, and asked me for some water. I went out to get some, and when I came back, he'd taken his file off my desk and was reading through it like a madman. Not that he would have been able to understand a word of it, of course, he wasn't a doctor. But it was as if he wanted to prove to me that I was wrong. I took the file back and handed him his water, but his hands were trembling so badly that he spilled it all over himself when he tried to drink it. When I finally calmed him down, he told me that there was no way I could be right in my diagnosis, and he wanted a second opinion. "You can have one, of course," I told him, "but it's not going to change anything. There are very specific tests in place today for how we identify the virus, and there's simply no doubt about it whatsoever. I'm very sorry." I shook my head in sympathy, and as I glanced around, I noticed that the people at the table next to ours were watching us with disgusted expressions on their faces. I caught the eyes of one of the men. He was well into his 50s, bald and obese, with an enormous steak bleeding onto the plate before him. And he simply stared back at me with utter loathing before turning back to his friends. "Despite all this," continued Bastian, "patient 741 was still not willing to accept the truth. He wanted to know who the best doctor in the field was. Where was the best hospital? He insisted that someone must be able to help him. That someone would be able to prove me wrong. But doctor," he said, leaning forward and taking me by the shoulders as if he wanted to shake some sense into me, "I can't possibly have that disease. Do I look like a queer? I'm normal, for Christ's sake." "You see," said Courtney, sitting back and throwing her hands in the air. "No education. No understanding at all."
"And did he come to terms with it in time?" I asked.
"Well, he had to," said Bastian. reaching across and taking my hand for a moment and squeezing it. Despite how close we were with Alex and Courtney, there was still a moment where I noticed how their eyes glanced towards our hands, and they seemed a little embarrassed by our physical affection. He had no choice. When I told him that he would have to contact all the women he'd been intimate with and tell them that they needed to get tested too, he said that he didn't even know the names of half the women he'd slept with in the last year, let alone their phone numbers. Then he said he wanted a blood transfusion. "Take all my blood out and replace it with good blood," he said. But I told him that that was ridiculous, that it didn't work like that. "But I'm not fucking gay," he kept insisting. "And where is he now?" I asked. "At Mount Sinai," said Bastian. "He doesn't have long left. He was admitted a few weeks ago, and it's only a matter of time at this point. In the end, I had to call security. He started to lose his mind, came around to my side of the desk, pinned me up against the wall, and..."
"He did what?" I asked.
"He pinned me up against the wall. He said he knew that I was a dirty faggot, too, and that I shouldn't be allowed anywhere near patients, that I was probably infecting them one by one."
"Oh, for God's sake," said Courtney. "Did he hurt you?" I asked.
"No. Look, this was a year ago, anyway. Then I was bigger than him, then stronger. But I could have taken him down if I'd needed to, but I was able to control the situation, to calm him down, to make him realize that his anger would not help. Finally, he backed off, and that's when he just crumpled and started to cry. 'Jesus Christ,' he said, 'what will they say at home? What will they think of me?'"
"Where was home?" asked Courtney.
Bastian hesitated for a moment and turned to me. "Well, that's the thing," he said. "He was Irish."
"You're kidding me," I said. "I haven't even kept up with what's going on over there.
Do people have AIDS in Ireland, too?"
"People have it everywhere, Cyril," said Alex. "Probably on a much smaller scale, but there's bound to be a few cases."
"So why didn't he go home to die?" I asked. "Why stay in America?"
"He said he didn't want his family to know, and he'd rather die alone here than tell them the truth."
"You see," I said, "that country never fucking changes. Better to cover it all up than to face up to the realities of life." I looked up as the waiter came over to the table and stood before us, smiling nervously. He had enormous bouffant hair and was wearing a leather waistcoat with no shirt underneath, revealing a hirsute chest, and looked as if he belonged on stage with the rest of Bon Jovi.
"How was your dinner?" he asked,
and before we could reply, his expression grew noticeably anxious.
"I'll just leave this here for you for whenever you're ready," he said, laying a small silver tray on the table and turning around to walk away.
"What's that for?" asked Alex, summoning him back. "No one asked for the check."
"I'm afraid we need this table," said the waiter, glancing towards our neighbors for a moment.
"We didn't expect you to stay this long."
"We haven't even been here an hour," I said. "And we haven't had dessert or coffee yet," said Courtney. "I can give you some coffee to go, if you like."
"We don't want coffee to go," she snapped. "Jesus Christ!"
"Just take the check back and we'll order something else when we're ready," said Bastian.
"I can't do that, sir," said the waiter, looking around for reinforcements, and I noticed a couple of his colleagues gathered near the bar area watching what was going on. "This table is reserved for another party."
"Well, where are they?"
I asked, looking around.
"They're not here yet, but they're on their way."
"I can count at least 4 empty tables," said Courtney. "Seat them at one of those."
"They specifically requested this table," said the waiter.
"Then it's hard luck," said Alex, "because we're here first."
"Please," said the waiter, looking at our neighbors again, who were watching with smiles on their faces. "Don't make a scene. We have the other diners to think about."
"What's going on here exactly?"
said Bastian, throwing his napkin down on the table and growing angry now.
"Are you throwing us out? Is that what's going on here? Why? What have we done?"
"We've had some complaints," said the waiter.
"About what?"
I asked, completely baffled.
"Why don't you just do what the man says and get the hell out of here?"
came a voice from the next table, and we looked over at the man with the steak who was staring at us in disgust.
"We're trying to have a nice dinner, and all we can hear from you people is a lot of talk about that queer disease. If one of you has it,
Then you shouldn't be in a restaurant anyway.
None of us has it, you moron, said Courtney, turning on him. These two are doctors. They treat victims of AIDS.
I think you misunderstand the meaning of the word victim, said one of the women. You're not a victim if you're asking for it in the first place.
What the fuck? I said, looking around, half amused and half shocked by what I was hearing.
Waiter, you need to throw away all their plates and cutlery, said the man. No one else should have to weed off them after these people. And wear gloves, I advise you.
It took just a moment for Bastian to be on his feet and marching over to the table. The waiter stepped back in fright, and Alex jumped up, as did I, uncertain what to do at a moment like this.
Let's just leave,
said Courtney, grabbing Bastian by the arm as he passed her.
But don't think we'll be paying the bill, she added to the waiter. You can stick that where the sun don't shine.
What's the matter with you?
Asked Bastian of the fat man, pushing him with both hands against the chest as he stood too, and his Dutch accent became more pronounced the more furious he got. This was something that happened whenever he grew really angry. I called it the tone, and dreaded its rare appearance.
You think you know what you're talking about? You don't understand anything of what you're saying. Develop a little humanity, why don't you? Get the fuck out of here before I call the police, said the man,
not even slightly intimidated despite the fact that Bastian was younger, fitter, and taller than him.
Why don't you and your friends go down to the West Village? They'd be happy to serve all you perverts whatever you want down there.
I could see Bastian trembling as he summoned all his self-control to stop himself from picking the man up and throwing him through the windows. But finally, controlling his temper, he turned around and walked away. We made our way to the doors and left, the eyes of everyone in the restaurant on us as we marched back out onto 23rd Street, where the lights from the corner offices of the Flatiron shone down on us.
Fuckers,
said Bastian, leading us down the street towards a bar where we had every intention of getting riotously drunk.
Bunch of fucking fuckers. They'd have a bit more decency if one of them came down with it.
I wish they would.
I wish they all would.
You don't mean that, I said, wrapping my arms around him and pulling him close to me.
No,
he whispered with a sigh, as his head rested on my shoulder.
No, I suppose I don't.
Patient 563. The curtains were drawn in room 711, and in a husky voice that sounded as if it had not been used in some time, the young man asked me not to open them. Enough light was seeping through, however, to allow me to make out the figure in the bed. He was around 20 years old, but probably weighed no more than 100 pounds. His arms, which were lying on top of the sheets, were stick-thin, his long fingers skeletal, the elbow joints inflamed beneath the hospital gown. His face was gaunt, the skin stretched taut against the skull beneath, in an anatomical miscreation that summoned images of Mary Shelley's monster to my mind. Lesions on his neck and above his right eye. Dark, black bruises that melted into the skin appeared to pulsate as if they had a life of their own. Shaniqua had told me that if I ever felt uncomfortable, then I should leave, that it wasn't fair for a patient to witness my discomfort. But I had never done such a thing yet. Today she had insisted that I wear a gown and a mask, and I had followed her instructions, even though the boy's bed was covered in a white plastic tarpaulin that reminded me of the scene at the end of E.T. when Elliot's house is quarantined by the government and the alien appears close to death. I told him my name and explained why I was there, and he nodded, his eyes opening a little wider, as if he was trying to physically draw some more life into his body. And when he tried to speak again, the words came out as a sequel to the prolonged bout of coughing.
"It's good of you to come," he said. "I don't get many visitors. I haven't had one in weeks, other than the chaplain. He comes every day. I've told him I'm not religious, but he comes anyway."
"Do you want him to stop?" I asked. "Because if you do..."
"No," he said quickly. "No, I don't want him to stop."
"All right, then," I said. "How are you feeling today?"
"Like the end is nigh," he said, laughing a little.
which turned into another series of coughs that lasted for more than a minute and brought me out in a cold sweat. "Relax, you can't catch it," I told myself. "You can't catch it just by standing here." "Do you want to tell me your name?" I asked. "You don't have to if you don't want to. They just identified you as patient 563 to me."
"It's Philip," he said. "Philip Danley."
"It's nice to meet you, Philip," I said. "Are they making you comfortable at least? I'm so sorry that this has happened to you." He closed his eyes, and I thought for a moment that he was falling asleep. But then he opened them again and turned to look at me, breathing in so deeply that I could see his chest rise and fall beneath the blanket. I imagined how pronounced his ribcage would look beneath the skin. "Are you from New York?" I asked.
"Baltimore. Have you ever been there?"
"I haven't been anywhere in the States outside of Manhattan," I said.
"I used to think there was no point in going anywhere else. I only ever wanted to come here from the time I was a kid."
"And when did you first arrive?"
2 years ago, I came to study literature at CCNY.
"Oh," I said, surprised. "I know someone who's studying literature there."
"Who?" he asked.
"His name's Inyak Kreis. He's probably a couple of years older than you, though, so you may not."
"I know Inyak," he said, smiling at me. "Czech guy, right?"
"Slovene."
"Oh, yeah. So how do you know him?"
"I'm one of his guardians," I said. "Not in a strictly legal sense, but it's how things have been for 7 years. Not that he needs a guardian now, of course. He's 22 years old. Anyway, he lives with my boyfriend and me."
"I think he's going to be a famous writer someday," he said.
"Perhaps," I said. "I'm not sure fame is what he's after, though."
"No, I didn't mean that. Only that I think he's going to be very successful. He's a lovely guy. I've read a few of his stories. Everyone thinks he's very talented."
"Did you enjoy studying there?" I asked, biting my lip when I realized that I'd used the past tense, as if that part of his life was entirely over, which of course it was.
"I loved it," he said. "It was my first time outside Maryland. I'm still enrolled there, of course. Or maybe they struck me off their books. I don't know. It doesn't matter anymore, I suppose. My parents didn't want me to come here at all. They said I'd get mugged my first time out in the city."
"And were they right?"
"In a manner of speaking." "What do you do anyway?" he asked. "Do you work at the hospital?"
"No," I told him. "I just volunteer."
"And what do you do when you're not volunteering?"
"Not much. I think I'm turning into a 1950s housewife. I don't have an employment visa, so I can't legally do anything, although I work a few nights a week at a bar near where we live. My boyfriend earns enough to keep us both, so I guess I'm scrounging off him. Anyway, that's why I volunteer. I wanted to do something positive with my days."
"You're gay, then?"
he asked me. "Yes." "And you?"
"Yes," he said. "How do you think I got in this spot?"
"Well, not because you're gay," I said. "You can't think that's the reason."
"But it is the reason," he said.
"No, it isn't. There are plenty of straight patients on this floor."
"It's the reason," he insisted.
I came closer to him now and sat down in a chair. Despite the trauma that the disease had done to his face and body, I could tell that when he had been healthy, he would have been a good-looking boy. His dark hair, which was cropped close to his skull now, complemented his eyes, which were bright blue and could not be dulled by the worst efforts of the disease.
"Do you remember when we were kids?" he said eventually, turning to me again. "The time we took the sleigh up to Ratchet Hill on Christmas morning? You said that if we held on to the sides as tightly as we could, then we'd be okay. But you fell off and sprained your ankle, and Mom blamed me for it, and I was grounded for a week.
I don't think that was me, I said gently. Was that your brother, Philip? Are you thinking about your brother?
He turned his head and stared at me for a moment and frowned.
Oh, yes, he said, turning away again. I thought you were James. You're not James, are you?
No, I'm Cyril, I said.
Does your ankle still get sore in cold weather?
No, I told him. No, it healed. It's fine now.
Good.
A nurse came in and ignored us both as she took a reading from one of the monitors, then changed his IV bag before leaving again. As she did so, I glanced towards the bedside table where copies of The Sound and the Fury and Cats 22 were piled one on top of the other. You're a reader, I said.
Of course, he replied. I told you I study literature.
Did you want to write? Like Inyak?
No, I wanted to teach. I still do.
And Tyler's from Baltimore, isn't she? I asked, and he nodded. I've read a few of her books. I like them very much.
I met her once, he said. I worked part-time in a bookshop when I was in high school. She came in to buy some Christmas presents, and I went bright red. I was so in awe of her.
I smiled, and then, to my horror, I saw tears beginning to stream down his face.
I'm sorry, he said. You should go. You don't want to see me making a fool of myself.
It's fine, I told him. And you're not making a fool of yourself. I can't begin to imagine what you're going through. Can you... I hesitated, uncertain whether I should even ask. Do you want to tell me what brought you here?
It's ironic, really, he said. They say that you're most at risk of catching AIDS if you're promiscuous. Guess how many people I've had sex with?
I've no idea, I said.
One.
Christ, I said.
One. And even then it was only once. I've had sex one single time in my entire life, and that's what brought me here.
I said nothing. What was there to say?
I was still a virgin when I came to New York, he continued. I was a shy kid. Back in high school, I had crushes on practically every guy I knew, but I never acted on any of them and never told anyone that I was gay. They would have beaten me up if they'd known. They would have killed me. That's why I wanted to study here. I thought that maybe I could find a new life for myself. And it wasn't easy. For the first 6 months, I stayed in my dorm room, jerking off, frightened to go to any clubs or bars. And then one night I did. I just decided, fuck it. And it felt so good once I was inside. I felt like I belonged somewhere for the first time in my life. I'll never forget that sensation. How difficult it was to walk through the doors, and how easy it felt once I was inside. Like I was where I was supposed to be. And then some guy took me home. The first guy who talked to me. He wasn't even hot. Jesus. He was old. Old enough to be my father. I wasn't even attracted to him. But I was so desperate to get laid, to lose it, you know, and frightened of staying in a club where I didn't even understand the rules. So I went home with him and we had sex. It lasted about 20 minutes. And then I threw my clothes back on and ran back home. I didn't even know his name. And that was it. That's how I got it.
He took a long breath and shook his head.
Isn't that just the worst thing you ever heard?
I'm sorry, I said, reaching out and putting my hand under the tarpaulin to take his and mine. His skin felt paper thin, and I feared that if I squeezed too hard, I would hear his fingers break beneath the pressure. The universe is a fucked up place. "Will you tell Mom I'm sorry when you see her?" he asked. "Tell her that if I could go back, I'd never have done it."
"I'm not James," I said quietly, squeezing his hand. "I'm Cyril."
"Do you promise you'll tell her?"
"I promise."
"Good."
I took my hand back, and he shifted a little in the bed. "Are you tired?" I asked.
"I am," he said. "I think I'll get some sleep. Will you come back and see me again?"
"I will," I told him. "I can come in tomorrow if you like."
"Oh, I have classes in the morning," he said,
his eyes starting to close now.
"Let's catch up on Saturday."
"I'll come back to see you tomorrow," I said, standing up and watching over him for a few minutes as he drifted off to sleep. Emily. The noises emerging from Inyak's room told me that he and Emily were at home, and my heart sank deeper than the Titanic on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean. I made sure to close the front door with as much force as I could and coughed a few times to give them notice that I was back, and my reward was a series of giggles followed by a hushed silence as I made my way into the kitchen. 5 minutes later, sitting at the table with a cup of coffee and flicking through a copy of Rolling Stone that Bastian had left there, I glanced up as Emily came in, barefoot and wearing one of Inyak's shirts open halfway down her chest, revealing a little more of her breasts than I really needed to see. Her denim shorts were cut off high up the thigh, and the top button was noticeably open while her hair, which she normally wore up on her head in a messy bird's nest, was hanging loose around her shoulders. "Hey, Mr. Avery," she said in a sing-song voice, wandering over to open the fridge. "Please, call me Cyril," I told her. "I can't say that name," she said, waving her hand in the air and pulling a face, as if I'd made some perverted request of her. "It's a weird name. Every time I hear it, I think Cyril the Squirrel." I turned around with a jolt, recalling how Bridget Simpson had insisted on calling me by that very name some 28 years earlier in the Palace Bar on Westmoreland Street. Bridget, Mary Margaret, and Bean were all dead now, of course. And Julian? Well, I had no idea where Julian was. "What?" she asked, turning around. "You look like you've seen a ghost. You're not having some type of stroke, are you? It's not uncommon in men your age." "Don't be ridiculous," I said. "Just stop calling me Mr. Avery, all right? It makes me feel like your father, which would be very strange, considering I'm only 10 years older than you." "Well, that is quite a big difference, you know," she said, "and I don't want to be disrespectful by being too familiar." "It's exactly the same age difference as the one between you and Inyak," I pointed out. "And he doesn't call you Miss Mitchell, does he?" She took a carton of yogurt from the fridge, peeled the lid off, and looked at me with barely concealed amusement as she ran her tongue across the inside, some of the strawberry sticking to her lips. "He does when I tell him to," she said. "And anyway, I'm not 10 years older than Inyak, Mr. Avery. I'm only 9 years older than him." "And how old was Inyak again when you took him in?" Before I could say another word, Inyak himself appeared, and I had no choice but to let it go. He wasn't ignorant as to how I felt about Emily, and I knew that he didn't like it when we sniped at each other. She had timed her remark perfectly. "Hey, Cyril," he said, turning the kettle on. "I didn't hear you come in." "Yes, you did," I muttered. "You were otherwise engaged, Han," said Emily, without looking up. "How was school today?" I asked, turning around and wishing that Emily would either go into the other room and get dressed or leave. Or perhaps go to the fridge again, trip over on a piece of loose linoleum and fall out of the window into the middle of 55th Street. "Pretty good. I got an A on my Lewis Carroll paper, and another for my Yeats essay."
"Good for you."
I liked the fact that Inyak had taken an interest in Irish literature, much more than he ever had in Dutch or Slovene. He was working his way through most of the big Irish novels, although for some reason he'd chosen to avoid Maud's work for now.
I'd thought about buying him some copies from the Strand bookstore. They had some first editions in there that were quite reasonably priced. But I didn't want him to feel obliged to read her, and was uncertain how he'd feel if he did.